From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, what it takes to be a restaurant man. Vermouth, it's more than just the splash in your martini. Quark, find out what it is and how to make it. Plus, have you ever wondered what it's like to be an ice cream man? Hear the wild stories of the men and women behind the wheel of the ice cream truck. But first, as we do every week, let's see what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. There's been quite a bit of news lately about the overuse of antibiotics in animal feed, and we are at the Santa Monica Farmers Markets very proud of our antibiotic hormone-free meat offerings. We have beef, pork, lamb, goat, chicken, rabbit, and duck. Turkeys on the holidays. We've invited a new beef producer to participate in the market, hoping to get the message and the choice for antibiotic-free meat to more people. Today, we're talking with Mike Curry, who works with veterinarian John Novy, who has a cattle ranch, Shasta County, a closed herd Angus ranch. And Mike, you are always so excited about this meat. You're here at the market. You're going to be on alternating Wednesdays throughout the summer. Tell us briefly, explain why the beef that you have here is the best.
Well, it starts with the animals. We really pamper our animals. We take it very, very seriously. All of our animals, the breeding bulls, are DNA tested for various tenderness factors, and then all the animals are ultrasound tested for their marbling and for the fat content. If they're not over 5%, which is the equivalent of USDA choice, then we sell them off. So all of our meat, we have for grass-fed beef, we have probably the best marbling you can get. We feed all of our animals a blend of fescue, wheatgrass, and clover, all from organic Oregon seed. We have three large 2,000 to 3,000 acre pastures, so there's always tall grass and plenty of fresh stream and pond water. You know, we just treat them very, very well. They just wander around mooing and chewing, and they have a pretty good time.
So the marbling, I mean, a lot of people say that the grass-fed beef is either gamey or it's stringy or it's tough or it's lean. So how do you mentioned briefly, but how do you really counteract that?
It's a closed herd, as you mentioned earlier, so no outside animals have been in for many, many years. And by the ultrasound testing and the DNA testing of the bulls, we've developed a strain over the years with really phenomenal marbling. We are USDA certified, and there are USDA inspectors are out at the ranch very regularly, and they know our animals. They know the ear tags, and the same inspector will go to the meat processing point, and they see the same animals being processed. And our inspector said if he didn't know the animals, he would swear that they couldn't have that much marbling from grass-fed beef. With our grass-fed beef, you'll notice a much more distinctive flavor between each individual muscle group. So even a ribeye and a petite ribeye right next to it will have a slightly different flavor.
And when you have yours custom cut, and there's probably some cuts people aren't familiar with. Can you mention some of the more unique cuts you have?
We have culottes, which is a kind of a sirloin top cap. People in Brazil call it a picanha. It's a really very, very juicy, very tender roasted cut. We have bavettes. Now, bavettes are typically a roast. They're a larger roast. It's an underbelly cut that's an irregular shape, and butchers usually keep them because they don't merchandise well, but it's my personal favorite cut. They're really phenomenal, very tender, very juicy, and we cut them smaller, so they're actually more steak and grill size. We have ossobuco, we have oxtail, we have sweetbreads, we have Rocky Mountain oysters, only once a year. We only butcher bulls once a year, and so we just happened to do that very recently. And we have everything. We have bones, neck bones, marrow bones, knuckle bones, and a little bit of everything.
Okay, well, Mike, thank you so much, and I feel like I'm talking to a butcher, and this is great.
Well, thank you so much, Laura.
And now, as always, to help us negotiate our way through the ultimate enjoyment of the products that Mike was just talking about, we will turn to Amelia Saltzman, who's the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. And Amelia, you are brimming with ideas for how to prepare and cook and enjoy this wonderful grass-fed beef. So let us know.
Well, I'm very excited to have this new addition to the market. This is grass-fed beef. And I learned from my Argentine son-in-law, where in Argentina, that's all they have is grass-fed beef. There is a trick to cooking it. The trick is, because the meat is leaner, even if it has marbling, The trick is that you need to grill it over medium, not over high. Put it on a medium grill, and when you get close to where you want to be and you want some browning at the top, that's when you sear it. That's when you move it over to high heat or crank up the heat, and you finish it and get the crust at the end, not at the beginning. It's sort of counter to what we've all been taught. I happen to buy a flat iron steak today. That's what I'm going to play with.
And you salt it first? What about salting it before you cook?
I'm a big believer in salting the meat before you cook. The two other tricks, you know, you want to have it very dry, okay? And the other thing is to salt it. And, of course, salt will help dry the surface. I usually use a fairly generous amount, surprisingly generous amount of kosher salt, you know, to rub onto the surface of the meat, maybe 10 minutes before I'm ready to grill. And that helps just dry the surface.
All right, so that is just one cut. And as Mike said, he has over 20 cuts. So every week we can just keep experimenting and trying and comparing. And this is going to be a great grilling summer. Thank you, Amelia, so much.
My pleasure.
That was Amelia Saltzman once again helping us negotiate the fabulous bounty here at the market. And, of course, Amelia is the author of the Santa Monica Farmers Market Cookbook. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Find Amelia's grilling tips as well as a recipe for her steak salad on the Good Food blog. Gardening is one of those activities that yields much more than what you imagine the goal to be. For example, plant a beet seed, get a beet, right? Well, not really. There are constant extras. Willie Galloway is the author of Grow, Cook, Eat. She's discovered how surprising bonus edibles can be. Hi, Willie.
Hello.
I so love that you talk about this because pretty much all my life I've considered myself a garbage eater. I love eating roots and skin and leaves, things that most people don't normally think of as being edible. But when you garden, you get to have a whole new insight into this, don't you?
Yeah, when you grow your own food, you get to observe the plant's entire life cycle. And because it's right out there in your garden, if you're adventurous or curious, you can also sample the food at different stages and try, you know, not just the main crop, the beet, but also the leaves when they're little teeny baby leaves or when they're bigger. And so it really opens the door to a lot of interesting foods that you just don't really find at grocery stores.
So let's talk about the radish, because that's the one that got you started on this extra edible kick.
Yeah. So radishes, you know, I feel like most people don't like radishes, which is really unfortunate because they're great. But most people run into them on some sort of horrible crudité platter, you know, at a work event. And it's this spicy, pithy, totally unattractive radish that's just left over there with the cauliflower on the side. And, you know, radishes just really don't taste good that way. They are best when they're fairly small. I like them when they're kind of about the size of a half dollar or smaller. And they are sweeter and crisp when they're just straight from the garden. And they also have a lot of edible parts. So there's the root, of course. But then they have these delicious greens. And most people probably don't pause and think to eat them because they have this kind of Velcro texture when they're raw. But that disappears when you cook them. They have this really sort of delicious mineral kind of flavor. They can be used in any recipe that calls for cooked spinach. And when they go to seed, they also have beautiful flowers that make a pretty garnish on salads. And then they make these amazing seed pods that are crunchy and crisp and spicy. And in Asia, often they'll grow radishes just for the pods, in addition to, you know, there's many wonderful Asian radish roots as well. But the pods are a definite bonus.
So what are you enjoying right now seasonally as an extra?
Well, so yesterday I just harvested what you'll often see at farmers markets referred to as rob. So many plants in the brassica family, which is the cabbage family, produce these really tender flower buds that look like broccoli. So I had broccoli rob in my garden. I just cleaned out my garden yesterday because it was finally a nice day. So I harvested the rest of the broccoli rob. My kale also had little flower buds. I had some purple sprouting broccoli that was making side shoots. And so I harvested all those rob, and tonight I'm going to just stir fry them with some garlic and a little bit of lemon zest, and it'll be this delicious treat. And they're really pretty.
You know what's so funny about almost every single thing that you mentioned as being this extra thing is now it's what chefs are paying a premium for in farmers markets.
Yeah, you know, what's so funny is that a lot of the extras are what is available right at the end, right before a farmer or a gardener is going to pull the plant out. There's this extra kind of tidbit. And so farmers caught on to the fact that, you know, these foods are good, and they started selling them as a premium at farmers markets because they are typically only available for a short period. And chefs caught on, and I'm excited. I think that there's a movement that's gaining traction to really think about the whole plant and how we can eat it and enjoy it.
So you mentioned the flowers. Are pretty much all the flowering parts of a vegetable edible?
Yeah, you know, in general, yes, most parts of vegetables are edible. There's a few exceptions, you know, for instance, you wouldn't want to eat rhubarb leaves. They're full of oxalic acid. But yeah, you know, flowers typically of most vegetables you can eat. And usually edible flowers often are kind of edible and they won't kill you if you eat them, but they're not very tasty. But I've found vegetable flowers are usually really good. So some of my favorite edible flowers are the brassica flowers. So arugula, kale, turnip, those all have great flowers, mustard green flowers, because they'll sort of taste like the vegetable, but with this little bit of sweet floral undertone. And another good way to choose edible flowers that you might want to eat, either stir-fried or as a garnish, is to pay attention to what flowers the pollinators visit. I've found that pollinators have good taste and that the flowers they like are usually pretty sweet and really just tasty.
Talk to me a little bit about what extras we can get from something like garlic.
Oh, man, garlic is an amazing crop. So I don't know why more people don't grow it, because first of all, it's so easy to grow. You just snuggle one of those little cloves down into the soil in fall, and then starting in spring, you just have this very long season of harvest. First of all, you can, when the garlic is young, the leaves are really tender at this stage, and they kind of taste like garlic chives. So you can harvest one or two leaves per plant. And interestingly, each leaf on a garlic plant represents one layer of that papery wrapper that eventually develops around the head of the garlic. Then when they grow up and they kind of look like green onions, you can harvest them at that stage. They're really good grilled or just sautéed. And then hardneck varieties of garlic, which are not, you don't always see them at the grocery store. They have this hard central stem and fewer cloves, but bigger ones. There's also a variety or types of garlic called softneck, and they have these sort of swirling layers of cloves, and that's usually what you see at the grocery store. But the hardneck varieties are my favorite because they produce what's called a scape. So that's the stalk and flower bud of the garlic, and they are amazing. They have this very mild garlic flavor that's also kind of grassy. I love to make pesto with them, but you can also grill them, and they're so amazing. They are worth growing garlic for all by themselves.
If you're going to harvest the scape, does it disturb the bulb?
Actually, so what you'll see in a lot of vegetable gardening books is they'll say, cut the scapes off because it will encourage the bulbs to grow larger. Period. And then they forget to mention that the scapes are really amazing and you should eat them too. So yes, cutting the scapes off is really great because it directs the plant's energy back towards forming a bigger bulb. And after you cut the scapes off, there's still one more stage of harvest before the mature bulbs, and that's green garlic, which you'll see it's becoming pretty popular at farmers markets. And that's when the head has formed, but the cloves are still fused together. And again, at this stage, the garlic is a little bit milder. You can cut up a whole head, and we like to at home make a whole grain salads with it, so farro or wild rice, and we'll saute the garlic and usually add feta cheese and maybe some greens in with the grains, and it makes a delicious salad.
Willie, this has been such a pleasure, and it's such a lovely book.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
That was Willie Galloway. She's the author of Grow, Cook, Eat. We'll have a few suggestions for bonus edibles, including a recipe for Willie's garlic scape pesto on the Good Food blog. Coming up, have you ever wondered what it's like to drive an ice cream truck? We'll meet a few of the personalities who sit behind the wheel of those singing trucks in 30 seconds, right here on KCRW and KCRW.com.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Welcome back to Good Food. To kick off the summer, we're focusing on spirits and cocktails for the month of June. And this week, we're taking a closer look at vermouth. If you spent time in Europe, maybe you've had some of the sweet elixir in a glass with that little orange twist. And the dry stuff, well, isn't that just to miss the martini glass? Well, not anymore. Martin Duderoff joins us today for Vermouth 101. I asked him to tell us the proper way to consume it.
Any way you like. The one thing that would make me most happy is if Americans started finding the vermouths they like and just drinking them as they are. Because the ones that are really good are worth pouring into a glass and drinking. And they're wonderful aperitifs, something to have before dinner, because they have the aperitif function of stimulating your stomach, getting it ready to take on food. And also, they're just delicious. And even more importantly, it's not a big bucket of booze. I mean, I'm all for cocktails. I'm a big cocktail fan. That's how I actually got interested in all of this. But if you're planning to dine and drink wine while you dine and then possibly even contemplate an after-dinner drink, you don't always necessarily want to drink a whole lot of high-proof alcohol before you embark on that.
So, Martin, are we talking about sweet or dry vermouth primarily?
We are talking about sweet vermouth and dry vermouth and a variety of things that are neither. I actually don't really like the term sweet and dry because it actually can make things even more complicated. I usually organize the vermouths by color, red, white, and dry, which is really kind of straw-colored most of the time. But they're all sweet, a little bit. The dry is the least sweet, generally. The key thing in all of these aperitifs is the presence of various botanicals, generally ones that are at least somewhat bitter, or at least bitter botanicals are involved in them. In the case of vermouth, that would be wormwood.
I think about the bottle of vermouth that many of us grew up with that was sort of like the bottle of bitters, and it was in our parents' cabinets forever. Do these spirits last forever, or do they have a natural lifespan?
The problem with them is that they tend to just sort of deteriorate after you open them, and they change at different rates depending on what kind of components went into them. Generally, the drier it is, the quicker it oxidizes, and the quicker it develops off aromas, off flavors, a sort of staleness. The sweeter vermouths, which are generally the red ones, though, especially the sweetest of them, say Puntemes, which is probably the sweetest of all, or very close to being the sweetest of all, that probably has the best shelf life. But the real bottom line is you open this, you use it as quickly as possible, you keep it in the refrigerator when it's when you've still got some in the bottle. And I try to buy the small bottles whenever I can, because you just go through them that much quicker.
Give us some of the names. You mentioned Punti Mace. Give us some of the other brand names and share with us what the flavor profiles are.
I would roughly organize the world of these products into four main groups. Three of them are old world. One is the vermouth from Piedmont, from Torino, and that's where vermouth really originated, especially as a commercial product, but also it's an intense local custom. That's where vermouth came from. The first commercializing entity was Carpano. It's a very rich, sweet red vermouth with complex botanicals. It's not the heaviest bodied, but it works fairly well as a template for what one thinks of as a darkly flavored rich red vermouth. And that same firm produces Antica Formula and Punti Mace, which are both available in the United States. Punti Mace has extra bitters in it. And then Antica Formula, which is a really important product, that really revitalized this category when it was introduced a little over 10 years ago. And that's a vanilla-flavored vermouth. It's very rich. It's almost thick in the glass. It's very well suited to drinking on its own. And it pairs very well with barrel-aged spirits, so it's been very popular with Manhattan drinkers and people like that. As you move into Savoy, onto the French side where Chambéry is, they responded to that with the white and dry styles. In the case of the dry style, it's what we've been thinking of over here in the U.S. for the last 150 years or so in conjunction with Martini. The white is something that was never very well known on this side of the Atlantic, but it's becoming more popular now. It's a sweet vermouth, but it has no color, and it's very beguiling for some of us. I particularly am very fond of Dolan's white vermouth. And then in Marseille, there was a different tradition of dry vermouth that came to be that was more water-oriented, more their geography. Whereas in Chambéry, you have a lot more alpine elements that they're using for their botanicals. In Marseille, it's about aging their vermouth by the sea and picking up on some of that. They use their vermouth extensively in cuisine. And the only surviving brand, in fact, from there is Noy Prat. Very different character than what's coming out of Chambéry. The fourth group, which I really don't want to overlook, are the new vermouths that are being produced here in the United States. They do not neatly fit in with the old world vermouths. You can't really fairly pigeonhole them in to say, oh, this is a dry vermouth or this is a red vermouth or what have you. We have Vaya out of Madera, California, which was a very early producer of vermouth. There's a new one on the market called Imbue that's quite lovely. Sutton Cellars in San Francisco is making a really neat vermouth as well. And in all of these cases, there are wines that reflect the people who are making them as well as the geographic context that they're made in.
Martin Duderoff writes the websites CocktailDB and Vermouth101.com. Find the list of Martin's recommended vermouths on the Good Food blog and let us know what you decide to do with them. Now let's turn our attention to another summertime treat, and this one isn't just for adults. It's ice cream. Before there were Korean tacos rolling around town on wheels, there was the Good Humor Man. Around the turn of the century, there was a guy named Harry Burt. He had a soda fountain in Youngstown, Ohio, and he came up with a chocolate-covered ice cream bar on a stick. He sold the novelty from trucks with the slogan, "Get into a good humor." And the rest, as they say, is history. But by the mid-80s, the men in the white uniform and black bow ties had mostly been replaced by freelancers. And while there were still Good Humor bars, popsicles like Bomb Pops were all the rage. Filmmaker Eddie Schmidt has more.
When I was growing up in Staten Island, New York, the ice cream man would come to my neighborhood, but never drove down my actual street. So we'd hear the jingle or maybe catch a glimpse of the truck and then tear off to try to catch him. Most of the time, though, he just drove away. So it shouldn't have surprised anyone when I decided to chase down ice cream trucks for my first documentary in 2002 called Popsicle Culture.
My name is Jim, your friendly ice cream man. We love you. Thanks, Jim.
And so does God.
Jimmy's originally from Puerto Rico, but now he's stationed near Washington Square Park in New York. A gray-haired guy wearing a white t-shirt and aviator glasses, he hands ice cream out the tiny window of his truck that says Custard King on the side. That's right, Custard King, with two Ks.
Jim, tell us, what's it like to be an ice cream man?
Well, it's a job. Some people, it's a part-time job. For some people, it's a full-time job. For me, it's been a full-time job for 20 years.
How did you end up doing it?
Well, when I was about 42, I used to drive a tractor trailer. The company went out of business. So I went 2 years without work. Very desperate for a job. I wound up in the ice cream business. Ever since then, I did pretty good, so I stuck with it.
So you're a happy man.
Well, I tell you what, I brought the bacon home. I gave my wife, my children, a middle income living. We didn't get rich, but we didn't get in debt either.
Right.
Sean is a spiky-haired ice cream entrepreneur in Austin, Texas. Imagine a young Sting crossed with Matthew McConaughey, shirt on, and you've got Sean. In case you weren't sure what he's selling, Sean's graffitied ice cream in big red letters across the top of his old van.
About how much do you make on a good day?
In my 2-hour work day, I can make like, on a really good day, maybe like $50 in 2 hours. But on an average day, about $20.
That's not a lot of money. But for Victor, in the Echo Park neighborhood of Los Angeles, driving an ice cream truck is better than what he did before. Victor used to work at a meatpacking plant from 8 at night until 6 in the morning. He says it paid very little and the managers took credit for all the hard work. Being your own boss is one of the benefits of driving an ice cream truck, but Victor still wouldn't want his kids to do it. This is no great thing, Victor says. There's no future. It's clear that no one's getting rich driving an ice cream truck. Plus, you gotta deal with kids.
Give me the dollar now. I did. He ripped me off.
What?
He ripped me off.
Wait a minute.
I paid.
If you had to list some qualities that you thought would be, you know, to do this job, you'd have to have those qualities, what would you say?
Patience, compassion, a love of kids, good manners.
Veronica plies her frosty trade in a working-class L.A. suburb called Downey. On the side of her old blue truck is a picture of Bugs Bunny, chilling out and having an ice cream.
Teach the kids to say please and thank you, not to say bad words.
Do you do that? Do you say, you know,
always,
say thank you?
Always, yes. And you're welcome, every little bit, because it really comes home to them.
But it isn't the kids that have been Veronica's nemesis. It's the other drivers.
So he spat on you?
He spat on the truck, yeah.
And what did he say?
Well, I couldn't hear what he said, but I wouldn't put that on camera.
What has he done to you at other times?
He tries down the street about 50 miles an hour and heads straight for the truck when you've got little kids standing there, you know? And the kids just, like, freeze.
Of course, there are some drivers that no one in their right mind would mess with.
My real name's Eric Service, but, people know me as,
like the Hulk Ice Cream Man, brother. What you gonna do when the Hulkster goes wild on you, brother?
The Hulkster's in the house.
With his blonde Fu Manchu mustache and a bright yellow headband, this suburban Michigan ice cream truck driver does look remarkably like a low-rent version of everyone's favorite wrestler.
Everybody always asks if I'm Hulk's brother or cousin or even if I'm Hulk. And some of the perceptive kids realize that if I was really Hulk or Hulk's brother, would I be driving an ice cream truck?
Woody?
No.
You gotta have a gimmick. In anything, you gotta have a gimmick.
But while other drivers might not bother the Hulkster, the cops just might. There are periodic news reports of drivers selling drugs out of ice cream trucks, but the rumors are still more widespread than the bona fide busts.
When you drive an ice cream truck, you always get accused of selling drugs. I don't. I mean, people might think I put drugs in the ice cream. If I was going to put drugs, I would save it for myself. Why would I waste it on little kids? They don't deserve it. What have you ever done to deserve it?
In reality, it's not the kids or the parents or the other drivers or even the cops that make life tough for ice cream truck drivers. It's that damn loudspeaker.
Does the soil in the truck drive you crazy?
No, it's like humidity. You know it's there, but don't let it bother you.
I don't even hear it anymore. It doesn't wake you up in the middle of the night. You don't hear the song in your head. And
13 years ago it did, when I first started. But it doesn't anymore.
Let's face it. When you're the driver of the truck and you're having to sit there for 7 or 8, 10 hours a day. I'd be lying if I say it didn't bother me.
Even with all the challenges, for most of the drivers I met, it's all about the cream.
Do you have any personal philosophies of life?
I think everybody should have some more ice cream. There's a lot of uptight people out there. And they all need to have a crunch bar or something.
For Good Food, I'm Eddie Schmidt.
Coming up, Quark. Learn what it is and how to make it in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Have you ever heard of Quark? I remember the very first time I tasted Quark. First of all, I knew I had to taste it because it had a name like that, and I was amazed at how close it was to cream cheese, and yet so far. Here to talk to us today about making your own Quark at home and what to do with it once you have made it is Noelle Carter. She's the test kitchen manager for the LA Times, and we love when she comes by to share her kitchen tips.
It's so great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and it's so much fun to talk to you about an ingredient that I really have come to love and use.
Yes, you know, it's such a simple ingredient. It's so like a cream cheese, but then you have that wonderful tang that you get that's almost like a sour cream. It's a great flavoring on its own as a dip, or you can add it to so many different things, sandwiches, breads, fruit, crepes, cheesecakes even. And it just adds a whole different dimension to whatever you're cooking.
Describe the texture of it, because the texture, too, is slightly different than cream cheese.
Our Quark was almost like a thicker yogurt. I mean, it was almost kind of a cross between a cream cheese and a yogurt. The curds were very fine. And when I first had a Quark that I really liked, I was almost concerned that maybe it wasn't Quark, which is why I took it to the Beverly Cheese Store to have Norbert taste it. And he assured me what I was making was Quark, and it was fine. But it's just such an amazingly smooth and soft texture. When we started testing it, and we had, I think we made over 2 dozen batches of Quark when we were coming up with the right recipe and refining it. And we were throwing it in everything. When we would test pasta dishes at the test kitchen, we would throw it in there, ragouts. One of my interns even added some chopped fresh herbs and made sort of a take on a ranch dressing. And it was just so wonderfully versatile. I mean, I fell in love with it.
Now, there's been a bit of excitement on the internet lately about making ricotta.
Yes.
How similar is it to that very simple process?
You know, Russ Parsons, our food editor, ran a story on homemade ricotta a couple of years ago, and I was amazed at how simple it was. You heat some milk up to a certain temperature, add a little vinegar, and then you wait for the curds to separate. Quark is similar. The recipe that we ended up going with was you heat some milk just to a simmer, no thermometer needed, remove it from heat and cool it to room temperature, and then you introduce your acid. We did not use vinegar. We used buttermilk, although I've also tried variations with lemon juice, and the flavor with that was wonderful too. But we went ahead and went with the buttermilk. You let it sit overnight, and it thickens to almost a yogurt consistency, and then you strain it overnight. And with both of those steps, each step took, oh gosh, about 12 to 24 hours for the curds to form and then to separate the curds from the whey. The ricotta was so much faster. It's a really fast cheese to put together. Quark takes a little bit longer, but and the results are a little different.
It's a little more complex.
Just a little, but it's still a simple recipe. I mean, my 11-year-old niece could make it if she wanted to. And the results are just divine. And it's so wonderful being able to say you're making your own fresh cheese.
This tang that you describe as the flavor, was it markedly different depending on which acid you used?
It was. It was. I found that with the buttermilk, there was, I would argue, a cleaner tang. I mean, it was cleaner, but it was softer and gentler. The lemon juice was really nice, and the cheese set up even more quickly than it did with the buttermilk. But I noticed that the lemon flavor kind of tended to predominate, which is nice if you're stuffing it into crepes or if you, you know, depending on what you're using it for. But if I wanted something with more of a neutral flavor, I found that the buttermilk seemed to work best. And we used cultured buttermilk that you can buy at the grocery store. I haven't tried it yet with homemade buttermilk, although I've been told from other people that have made it that it works just as well.
If we want to make our own quark and then use it in the kitchen with recipes we already have, is it a one-to-one substitution for cream cheese?
It varies on the recipe. We tried a bunch of different recipes using quark after we had made it. And it seems to be, you know, for ricotta or cream cheese, it seems to be generally one-to-one. With some of the recipes that we tried, I think there was a quiche-type tart recipe that we ran with the story. And that one, I believe, called for a substitution. You could substitute ricotta with a little sour cream just to give it a little extra tang. But for the most part, you can typically substitute a one-to-one.
Thank you so much, Noelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Noelle Carter is the test kitchen manager at the LA Times. We've been talking about making your own quark. It's time now to hear from another one of our favorite LA Times writers. Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer Jonathan Gold is here, and he's got a restaurant suggestion that's perfect for these warm summer days. We're headed to Roy Choi's latest restaurant, Sunny Spot, in Venice Beach.
It's Choi's take on, I guess, a Caribbean/Jamaican/swim-up rum bar menu.
Oh, that's really fun, and well-placed as well in terms of neighborhoods.
It is. The rum bar aspect is quite nice. I mean, they have a trillion rum drinks, and they've got a big list of rums that are hard to find everywhere else. And the drink that I became quite enamored of when I was there is a simple daiquiri, but made with Smith & Cross rum, which, as you know, is sort of like the manly leather strap of rums.
It's like the scotch of rum.
Yeah, definitely. And it's super high proof, so it is not your grandmother's daiquiri.
But a good one, nevertheless.
It is a good one.
Were you having some appetizers with that daiquiri?
Always. It's interesting. The rest of Choi's restaurants seem to be very much almost autobiographical, right? I mean, it's like you have A-Frame, which is the food equivalent of what he used to do during the summers in Hawaii, and you have Chago, which is very much sort of, you know, student food, and you have everybody's favorite Kogi truck. Here, he's going into a realm that's not necessarily his, but it plays pretty well to his strengths. You're having the rum and you're having, say, a flatbread with harissa and ricotta on it, which seems to mix like three or four different metaphors at once, especially with the charred rapini that's on it. But it turns out to be, you know, something spicy and a little bit sweet to have with your drinks. Or you have jerk chicken wings, which are coated with chili and allspice and are beautifully fried, but they come out somehow more like Korean fried chicken wings. I guess he can't help himself.
I love it. So it's sort of like metaphorically food from hot places.
And more specifically, Jamaica, though he's probably been to Jamaica, but it's not that specific. I don't think there's a single actual Jamaican food you could pin down.
Like I was going to say, is he making meat pies?
There are no meat pies. There's pig's foot, but not the pig's foot that you'd find on a Caribbean menu. These are pretty close to Filipino pata, actually.
Which are?
Fried pig's feet with the shank, and they're super, super crunchy. And they usually come with dipping sauce. And this actually also comes with a sort of chili vinegar sauce. that could be close to the chili water that you get in Hawaii. Or it could be something like abstracted and pineapple-y from Jamaica. You never know. I mean, it's all sort of mixing metaphors in a way that sometimes works very nicely. So you'll see short ribs on the menu, even as brown sugar scotch bonnet short ribs. And you'll be expecting one thing, but what you get is a vaguely Caribbeanized version of Korean galbi, you know, cut on the bias in the way that they call L.A. galbi, and serves sort of with this fruity habanero kind of sauce, vegetable mixture that's on it and over it. And you're having an experience that's nice and comes from some vague place.
Well, his food to me has always come from his imagination.
Right.
A mixture.
The more I think about it, actually, the more I'm starting to like this place. You know, some places that you go to a week ago and you've forgotten them. And this is a place where suddenly things become more vivid, like he has a dish of roast lamb with Jamaican spices that actually probably could come from a menu in Kingston or something, although they'd use goat instead of lamb. But he serves it with iceberg lettuce, and he serves it with pickled mango slices. You're supposed to pick up a bit of the lamb and put it in the lettuce and wrap it with the mango. And what we're talking about is we have a Jamaican psalm.
I love that.
With this Caribbean slash Asian food, you're probably going to want Caribbean dash Asian side dishes. Like they do a version of mofongo, which is the famous Cuban or Dominican like plantain side dish that they throw just handfuls of chopped bacon in, which makes everybody happy.
Now, I've heard that he does a mean torta.
The torta is interesting, and almost exactly as you would expect. It has a sort of pork, I guess you call it a terrine or kind of lunch meat-ish thing. And there's like ham, like prosciutto in there and provolone and mustard. And it's on a baguette. So it comes off very much as a cross between a Vietnamese banh mi, Italian hoagie, and something vaguely Caribbean. There's a bunch of things for dessert, but the one you're going to end up with probably is the sweet potato tart with the unfortunate name Weeby Yamen that comes with toasted marshmallow ice cream. Are you going to have rum with that?
Yeah.
And there's also a very nice coconut sorbet with a little bit of ginger in it that's perfect after you've been drinking rum all night and you want something just a little bit sweet and light enough to keep you going.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Sunny Spot on Washington Boulevard at Abbot Kinney in Venice. You can get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's favorite dishes by texting the words good food to the number 69866. If you have a smartphone and you haven't already done this, you're really losing out. Just text good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can also see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on the Good Food blog. Up next, do you have what it takes to be a restaurant man or woman? We'll hear from two restaurant owners about what it takes to stay relevant in a very tough business. That's next after this short break.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Lots of people think they want to be in the restaurant business. I've given my share of advice to some of them. But now all I need to say is go ahead and read the first 20 pages of the new book, Restaurant Man. Joe Bastianich, who along with his partner Mario Batali and sometimes his mother Lydia Bastianich, owns 25 smashingly successful restaurants worldwide. Here in L.A., he has Mozza. In New York, there's Babbo, Del Posto, and the list goes on and on. In his book, he tells you all you need to know about a brutal business in simple, blunt prose that's not for the faint-hearted. Hi, Joe.
Hi.
You know, a lot of people today, when they think about restaurant owners, they think of somewhat elegant, sophisticated people in a kind of rarefied environment. And you call your dad a blue-collar restaurant man. Could you kind of break that down for us?
Well, I mean, the business has evolved. You know, in the 70s when I was growing up, being a restaurant man was, there weren't even restaurateurs. These were immigrants who were, you know, working really hard to make a living. And they were serving people their ethnic food, going to the market, you know, working 20 hours a day sometimes to eke out a living. And I can remember as a child being, you know, embarrassed to tell people that my parents were in the restaurant business because it was such a, you know, it's just a servile job, very blue-collar, very demure, you know, compared to other people's dads who are lawyers, accountants, and dentists.
It must have been a very powerful lesson to watch the kind of dogged frugality that he had to pursue in order to make that life a successful one.
Well, yeah. I mean, and also, I mean, these people came from very difficult situations. You know, they came from facing hunger in their families, not having enough to eat. You know, that kind of, that changes your world a lot when you faced hunger and you have to come here and make a living. You know, you don't take anything for granted, and you work hard because the alternative to success is failure and poverty. So it's a pretty black and white world for the restaurant man of the 60s and 70s.
He taught you restaurant math. What is it?
Well, it's just basic paradigms. I mean, I think the concept more than the actual math is that restaurants fundamentally need to have margin, and you can be a great cook and a great host and a great artist and have the best restaurant in the world, but if you don't make money, it won't last and the restaurant will close. So it's the adage that, you know, commerce without margin is a hobby. You know, you have to create margin. These restaurants have to be profitable.
And what is the normal margin for a restaurant these days?
You know, we always, in the old days, we always strive to bring 20% to the bottom line. These days with the cost of commodities and proteins and rents, it's more like 15, and some people work for 10, and some people work for nothing. So there's no hard and fast rules, but we certainly like to try to bring more than 15% to the bottom line. The restaurant business, although it appears to be a business of generosity and grandeur, and when you walk into a restaurant, you know, it's actually a restaurant where you're losing money everywhere you look, and your margin slips away from you every second of the day. And really, frugality is about gathering nickels to make dollars so that you can have some margin.
When you were a kid growing up, was there ever a time that you weren't working in the restaurant?
No, I always worked in the restaurant, except for when I was a bagel baker.
Tell us about that period.
Oh, that was when I was young. I had a paper route, two paper routes, and I was a fairly ambitious kid. And I used to deliver the paper to the bagel den, and he recruited me, paid me $5 more a week than I was making on the paper route. And then I would go in the morning and bake bagels, and that's where I invented the everything bagel.
I love that you invented the everything bagel. Describe how you did that.
Again, it's an exercise in frugality and using what's left. So, you know, when you dust bagels with your various toppings, probably 70% of what you distribute goes into the pan below the bagel racks. And that was everything. Poppy, onion, garlic, salt, sesame, all together. And rather than throwing it out, we would repurpose it and top bagels with it, and we called it the everything bagel.
I love that so much. Mm-hmm. There are so many stories about what you did in the restaurant with your dad. Could you sort of share with us one of the worst, maybe the chicken experience?
Well, we used to go to Hunts Point in the mornings, you know, in the 70s and in the Bronx, and, you know, I mean, you've seen the movies. The Bronx was literally burning in the 70s. It was kind of like the Wild West where packs of wild dogs roamed the streets and, you know, prostitutes were out on the corners and truckers would come all over from all over the world and deliver produce. And we would go buy produce. And, you know, for a young 9 or 10-year-old boy, the experiences of being in that market are shocking. The volume of food, the volume and the type of humanity, and it truly is a market in every sense of the word.
Your plate is so full between TV, Italy, all the restaurants. What's percolating in your brain now?
Well, I'm heading off to Italy to host MasterChef there. We start shooting next week. We're going to do more Italy's, hopefully in Chicago next year.
What about L.A.?
And that's after. So we're actively looking for a location in L.A. Anyone has an extra 50 to 100,000 square feet that we could put in Italy and give me a call.
Thank you so much, Joe.
You're very welcome. Nice chatting with you.
That was Joe Bastianich. Joe and his partners own 25 restaurants worldwide, including Mozza here in L.A. His new book is Restaurant Man. Talking to Joe Bastianich, one might think that if you can keep the right margin, then anyone can run a restaurant, right? But running a restaurant is an art form, a craft that requires constant reform and attention. Piero Salvaggio of Valentino's restaurant in Santa Monica knows this so well. This year, he celebrates the restaurant's 40th anniversary, an incredible feat in such a tumultuous business. Good Food segment producer Laurel Garcia caught up with Piero as he explained what it takes to keep a fine dining restaurant relevant for 40 consecutive years.
40 years, as you can imagine, is an eternity in our business. It's long, long time, considering the span of mortality, considering the percentage of restaurants that make it. I remember in my younger days, I used to drive places like Melrose Avenue or La Cienega and just seeing new faces, new places, new sign. And that has been always the way the restaurant business goes. I have people that today tells me, oh, I haven't been here in 25 years, and I don't know why. The food is great, you are wonderful, but just it doesn't happen. And sometimes a restaurant is like a theater, and that means they saw the show once and they feel it's enough, or with so much happening, things kind of get forgotten. So our big issue and our big responsibility is to not be forgotten. Not be forgotten because you are in business, not be forgotten because all of your eggs are in this basket and you care to nourish it every day and to do it in the best possible way. And that is really, you know, to answer very shortly your question of longevity is theater. Every day you have to be on tap with a smile, with attention, with service, with details, and of course, good food, which is not just the title of your radio show, but is the reality of why people go to a restaurant. But then good food is not enough because it has to be food that makes sense today. The diets, the allergy, the farm to the table, the sustainability. There is so much now going on, and it's very important for us to stay on tap, to stay with whatever are the public demand, because at the end, they are the king.
So you are constantly reinventing yourself. How often does the menu change here at Valentino?
A lot of things change daily because it goes according to the market, according to the season, according to the fact that right now, for example, is soft shell crab time, is wonderful mushroom time. Changing is part of our repertoire, is part of the fun, and inspiration is the other part of the fun. So change is absolutely beautiful, especially in 40 years, you have some classic that people, no matter if we take it off the menu, want back.
Continuing on the theme of change, let's talk about just how the restaurant culture has changed since 1972. People come here to see you. As one of the few proprietors still here night after night greeting people at the door. And now we live in a culture of the celebrity chef, where people see somebody on television and might go to a restaurant to eat that person's food. Can you talk a little bit about how the environment has changed?
Yes. 72 to me was a very important year, not only on a personal base, but was the beginning of an evolution of food in California, an evolution of wine in California, an evolution of all of the influences that were brought here, because New Yorker used to have the business, but then the perfection of the dishes, the creativity of the dishes, the guts of doing things differently were all California based. So we saw this evolving that became big reality. I always remember that in the 80s, Los Angeles was the food capital of America. In the 90s, we start seeing changes. The baton, if you want to call it that way, passed from the restaurateur that was pretty much the ringleader, the direttore, the one that was kind of running the operation, to the celebrity chef. And it wasn't just because of Wolfgang Puck or things like that. It was because television change the way we see a restaurant, the way we make a restaurant popular, the way in the here and now of the website, of the blogs and so forth, we are so oriented on judging a restaurant and deciding where to go for a restaurant and deciding who are the star and the new kid on the block and so forth. So this last decade has been a real, real change. I think technology has been very influential. I think the whole syndrome of the big chef on television and then multi operator, especially places like Las Vegas, places like resort and so forth, where you put your signature, your crew, and basically you don't cook because you haven't cooked for ages. You basically now are an impresario, are all part of today's reality. What is missing is the human touch now, because you make a reservation on OpenTable. OpenTable is not going to be calling a restaurant and just saying, this is very special. You don't know how much I've been looking forward. I've saved money. I'm looking forward to pairing these wines. What are the special and so forth? Have a real conversation that prepares you to the main event. All of this now is based on telling somebody in a computer that you want to make reservation and that is your special 10th birthday and so forth. And sometimes I am disturbed by the fact that that human element, the theater that I was talking about, is being lost. You know, I miss those days when people were riding the three-star Michelin of France, were going to the pilgrimage in Switzerland to Freddy Girardeau, to some of the other great chefs, because, you know, events like that were part of a lifetime. Some of the memorable evening year, I know, are part of somebody's lifetime. That special celebration, that special birthday, that special anniversary, that's what a restaurant is 3 hours that you want to remember for a long time. And I hope there are enough people that still remember that this is what's all about. And it's called fine dining.
That was Good Food segment producer Laurel Garcia talking to Piero Selvaggio about his 40 years in business at Valentino's in Santa Monica. When was the last time you went out to a fine dining restaurant? Do you find that technology like OpenTable makes for a less pleasurable dining experience? Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Lara Garcia is our segment producer, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. Special thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.